Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Real as Yates podcast. We are your hosts, Paige Yates
and Taylor Yates.
And in this podcast, we share with you everything we know about real estate, Greater Boston, and life. And in case you're wondering, yes, we are in fact related. We are a top producing mother-son real estate agent team where we lead, surprise, the Yates team.
So, Mom, how are things going?
Good. I just wanted to report a follow-up to my bowling experience.
Okay.
My team made it to the roll-offs.
Okay.
Sadly.
Is that the playoffs or the finals or what?
To the final six teams.
Okay.
And we had six of us that had to bowl three times. And we came in third, which was pretty good because the other two teams tied. But most importantly is I actually rolled an 83, which was outstanding. I've never done that before.
Well, congratulations. I'm glad that you are, it sounds like you are an asset to your team. And, you know, who needs March Madness when you've got Paige Yates' bowling league?
Exactly. March Madness bowling league is just the best. And it's so funny because literally it has nothing to do with skill. It has just, it's complete luck. And if you happen to hit the pins down, so. It's fun, though, and it's really fun.
You can take credit. You can say there's some skill.
Yeah.
Right? And again, this is Candlepin, right? We talk...
Candlepin.
Yeah. And we've talked about before how, like, if you don't live in New England, you probably haven't played Candlepin. But if you do live in New England and you play something other than Candlepin, people are going to look at you crosswise.
Correct. But it's interesting because I did learn that there are kind of three types of pins. One, the regular for big balls.
Mm-hmm.
Candle pin, and then there's something called duck pins.
What's a duck pin?
It's a different shape of the pin. So same thing, you play with small balls, but the pins are smaller, but they're fatter. So I didn't know there were so many options in bowling.
Yeah. Right on. Well, cool. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed your league. So this month, we are talking about making an offer they cannot refuse. So we're going to break down all the different components of how to make a really good offer in real estate that maximizes your chances of getting the home without overpaying. And so we're going to start with price. So why don't we talk, Mom, about like what are some of the different ways that you use to figure out the right price for a property? Like you're going to an offer, the open house was busy, so you think there's going to be more than one offer. Like, where do you start?
So I think it depends on the price range that you're looking, right?
Yeah,
and the
totally.
Type of real estate investment you're trying to make, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're in a very competitive market and you're, say, spending around here $1 million, or 850 or 950, you tend to get very competitive in the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've talked to you about this before, which is sometimes I do a couple things. I look at the comps.
Mm-hmm.
I think in a situation where there are going to be multiple offers, you have to kind of be as creative as you can and push your envelope a little bit.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, I use escalation clauses to get us kind of into the range where they might accept it.
Yeah. Well, maybe let's bring it back. Before we get to there, let's bring it back to like the starting point, right? Because
how much is the house worth?
How much is the house worth? And first of all, the short answer to that question is that house is worth what one person is willing to pay for it.
Correct.
So you can do all the comps in the world. You can pull all the data in the world and you can be totally wrong because there's just somebody who wants that house and they want it badly enough to pay a number that you could never justify with the data. And that's true whether you're selling your home or if you're making an offer on a home. So just go into any bidding process with that in mind, right?
Correct.
You can do everything right and still lose. I will say, like, when I started, I still do this very structured approach to how I price out properties. But the more seasoned I get, the more I'm just able to be like, looking at that house in this town at this price point, like it's probably going to go for this, right? Like the finger in the wind method gets more and more accurate the more reps you get under your belt. And the example that I can give is contemporary homes, right? Or mid-century homes. We don't have a lot of those around here. And it's because a lot of our housing stock was built before that style came into being.
Or was popular.
And a lot of folks have been moving here like, it's come back, right? No small part because of the popularity of Mad Men and like the cultural impact of that show that we're still feeling today. But also, a lot of people are moving here from the West Coast, where that home style is very common. And if you're moving here from the West Coast, a lot of times you're coming with a bunch of money in your pocket. And so I know going into those mid-century bidding wars, I'm like, look, this is just, this number is going to start with a 2 and have 7 digits in it, right? And it's just, that is as accurate as any other method that I've used to price these out.
I think the other thing too about contemporary or mid-century modern, post-war, everybody built energy efficient homes as they could, mm-hmm. you know, shorter mm-hmm. ceiling heights. The windows weren't triple pane yet. Mm-hmm. So everybody was trying to build for low cost living.
Yeah.
Or at least moderate that as they could. Now that the construction has become so good mm-hmm. and we have things like insulated windows and doors, mm-hmm. houses that have all glass in a New England area sitting in the woods are becoming more popular.
Yeah, it's viable now.
It's viable because the energy efficiency that exists around it. Every time I go to a house, though, I always look at the comps. I start with that, even if they're kind of, some of them I might not understand because they're just either so low or so high, you just mm-hmm. don't get what was the motivation there.
Right.
And I also do look at per square foot pricing in a town because some towns have large pieces of land and land has value. And mm-hmm. other towns, you want a big house because they want big house and they don't care as much about the land. So
right.
you have to look at both sets of data. And the third thing that I do oftentimes when I'm not kind of in the suburbs and not in the city, but I always ask myself, is the land of this house more valuable than the house and the land combined? So
like, could you build something on it, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Is it more valuable to a builder? So
right.
I would say to you that intellectually, you start with the basics. And then as you referred to the finger method, you kind of in these bidding wars kind of go, okay.
You've just seen this a million times and you know how it goes.
Yeah. Right? And it's how badly you want it, mm-hmm. what price you're willing to pay or qualified to pay, and what the seller's willing to take and how competitive your offer is amongst the multiple offers out there.
Right. So I'll add a couple of other things to that list. And then I think it'd be helpful to our audience at home to dig into a couple of them. So another one I use is just the town growth rate. So the price growth rate. So you say, hey, you know, this person bought their house for X dollars. The town as a whole on average, prices have gone up by like Y percent per year. It's been Z number of years. So that gets us to this price, right? You're like, hey, if this house is just keeping pace, here's a good method. Now, there's some strengths and weaknesses to that way, but it's another important way to look at it. I also look at the highest price in the neighborhood. That's an important one because that should be a ceiling in most situations because most of the time you're not dealing with the best house in the neighborhood. And so you don't want to list for more than that, or you don't want to pay more than that as a rule of thumb. Then the last thing that I look at now is the automated valuation models. So meaning like the Zestimate, the Redfin estimate, or like we use a tool called HomeBot. And it's not because those are awesome. It's just because—
Or that you use them solely. Use them in collaboration with something else.
Right. You just use them because you know everybody else is looking at them. So to just ignore them outright feels silly. And you can come in and be like, look, I know this estimate says this. There's no way that's right. But just so you know, that's what everybody else is looking at. So we'll just keep that data point in the back of our mind.
So I have a question for you. I had an interesting question from one of my clients. I had an elderly woman, when I say that, she was selling her house for the first time in 60 years. She was in her 80s. And one of the things she had to figure out was it was jointly owned by herself and her husband. And mm-hmm. he had passed away in the year 2000, and I'm going to say one. So we had to go back 20 years mm-hmm. to figure out what the value would be. She called the town assessor, and he gave her a price because she was trying to figure this out for capital gains and filing of her taxes. How would you go back and give her a price, let's say 20 years ago? How would I calculate? Because I'll tell you what I did. So you're saying
like, hey, are you talking about like the town growth rate method? Like, what do you do if you don't really have a starting price?
Could you apply that to her? Or what method would you use to apply kind of previous pricing?
Yeah. So let's just start with why I was laughing when you said she went to the town assessor. Town assessors are by far the least accurate estimate of your home's value, at least around here, because they're not trying to find the market value of your house. They're just trying to raise tax revenues for the town. And so that they have formulas they go through, they have regulations they have to follow, and none of it has anything to do with the market value of your home.
And on top of that, they never go into your house.
Right. They never go into your house.
So they're probably half 50% to 70% of the houses that they've never walked through the door and seen.
Mm-hmm.
So they're comparing you to a 4-bedroom, 2,500 square foot house around town.
Mm-hmm. Correct. So, you know, none of these methods are perfect. And in this situation, I might just skip that. Like, I think that is a terminal problem with the town growth rate method, is if you don't have an original price, like, you can't do it, right? But my fallback for everything is always just the regular old comps. Like, here's a house that's similar, here's the way it's better, and here's the way it's worse, here's how much I think that nets out to the price on this place.
It's interesting because you couldn't really do that because it was so many years ago. So what
that's what I'm saying is there was no original price.
Right. So what I did is, it used to be that people looked at real estate as an investment equal to a savings account investment. And basically, you could get 5% return on your savings account. So the theory was real estate should go up 5% each year. So I actually did the reverse. From the sale price, I went down 5% per year until I got 20 years.
Yeah, there you go.
And that was the only way I could think of. Now, obviously, the market's jumped and gone down. We've had good years and bad years.
Yeah, but it kind of averages out. Like, it's not a terrible way to start.
But it was the only way I could think of. So I just wondering if you could use your town growth method, if that would have been a better way for me to do it, or whether or not the system I used was the best I could come up with.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good way of doing it. And that's part of why people pay us what they do, because sometimes you have these situations that don't fit neatly into the existing boxes.
Right. I kind of had to come up with a tool outside the box that was fair to her. Obviously, she was 82 and she'd never lived in any other house but her parents, but this one. And the town, as you said, doesn't necessarily have accurate records. So it was an interesting calculation that I had to be creative with.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll be back with some questions from the audience. Did you know that Paige and I aren't just your favorite real estate podcast hosts? We're also pretty darn good at our day jobs too. With over 30 years experience and $1 billion sold in Greater Boston, we're real estate agents you can trust. If you're buying or selling a home, reach out to us at contact@yatesboston.com today. All right. So, Mom, I hear this week you have a joke for me.
Yes, I do.
I can't wait.
I did a lot of research on good real estate jokes.
Okay.
I'm sure I could have asked my grandson, Asher, and he would have found one for me. But I actually did it all by myself.
Yeah.
So I like this one very much.
Got it. Let's hear it.
Why did the mortgage go on a diet?
Why did the mortgage go on a diet? It wanted to cut its eating rate? I don't know.
It wanted to reduce its principal.
Okay.
I thought it was pretty good.
That was cute.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right, so we've got a question from the audience this week. So how much is waiving a contingency worth? If I waive a contingency, can I get a discount on the house? So I get this question a lot. Do you get this question a lot?
I always get the question of, what do I have to waive to get this house?
Yeah, so that's the correct question to ask. But this comes up with a lot of first-time buyers, which, you know, just the season of life I'm in, a lot of my clients are like that. So they're like, hey, if I waive the mortgage contingency, does that mean like I get like a $5,000 discount on the house? Or, you know, depending on the price point, it could be a lot more. Or inspection, et cetera. And I think that's the wrong way to think about it. I mean, we'll talk more about contingencies in a later episode, but contingencies, I think, is the things that get you over the finish line, right? Like the, if you're running a marathon, your price is the thing that gets you to like mile 25.
It's kind of the price of entry.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, the contingencies are how you win. It's how you do that last 1.2 miles. So I don't really think there's a money value you can put on these. But yeah, you know, it's a fair question, but unfortunately, it doesn't have an answer.
I would say to answer that question that there isn't a discount of price by waiving contingencies.
Well, thanks for that awesome question. If you're a curious cat and would like your question to be considered, you can just send us an email at contact@yatesboston.com or slide into our DMs at Yates Team Boston.
That's it for this week. Be sure to tune in next week wherever you find your podcasts. If you like this, be sure to like, subscribe, and give us that 5-star review. You can also find us on Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok at Yates Team Boston or on the web at yatesboston.com.